My first Sunday at Wooddale Church, which was almost 23 years ago, I parked our family car in the side lot and came in a back door and walked down a basement hallway. And it was a little bit like going the first day to a new school, kind of nervous. Passed some people in the hallway who apparently had absolutely no idea who I was. And at the end of the hall, I overheard someone say, "That looked like our new pastor." So I thought maybe I was in the right place, and took a little more, I think, encouragement later that day when I found out that in one of the adult Sunday school classes that first Sunday morning, someone had prayed and asked for God's blessing and thanked the Lord for our new pastor, Leif Erikson. And I thought to myself, didn't he, like, discover America or something? Hasn't he been dead for maybe half a millennium? It was a humbling experience. Now, there's a difference between being humble and being humbled. Being humbled is when you are sort of lowered in the eyes of others or in your own eyes, whereas to be humble, to have humility, is something different. It is when a person does not think too highly of himself or herself. It's not to have a low self-esteem, not that at all, but that you choose to put others ahead of yourselves. Jesus was humble. The Bible says that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. We're told in Philippians chapter 2, that Jesus didn't think that being God was something in terms of its power and prestige that he had to hold on to, but instead that he became human. Not only human, but a servant, and not only a servant, but a servant who was willing to die, and not any ordinary death, but death by crucifixion. And so we learn a lot from Jesus about humility. And some of those lessons are written into Luke's biography of Jesus in Luke 14. It's verses 1 through 14 and on page 1621, and it reads like this. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. There in front of him was a man suffering from dropsy. Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him away. Then he asked them, "If one of you has a son or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull him out?" And they had nothing to say. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. "When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, 'Give this man your seat.' Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, 'Friend, move up to a better place.' Then you will be honored in the presence of all your fellow guests. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Then Jesus said to his hosts, "When you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous." So in this story of Jesus, there are all these great lessons about humility. Lesson number one is that the humble person cares about people in need. It is one of the signs of humility, one of the surest points of identification. I've been personally blessed by some truly humble people, people who have cared about me. Perhaps one that I remember most of all is a Wooddaler known to many of you, and that was Joan Hollister Gilbert. Joan was a delightful person who had a long and difficult and courageous battle against cancer. And then during her own illness, her husband Jack was diagnosed with cancer, and she had to deal with that and eventually with Jack's death. A few years later, when Joan was dying, just a few days left to her life, she invited Charlene and me to come and to sit by her bedside. She did something that, at least in my experience, is fairly unusual, and that is she readily said, without being asked, readily said that she knew she was going to die. And she talked about it. Most people in my experience choose not to do that. And she talked about the fact that she wasn't afraid, and she talked about being excited at entering the presence of God. But that was by far the shortest part of the conversation. For most of the time, she talked about people for whom she was concerned. She talked about us. She talked about our children. She named each of our children. She talked about her children and the children of others. And I found out that that day and the day before and the day after, leading right up to her death, she did, again, something most unusual. And that is that she invited a whole list of people to come to her bedside so that she could bless them before she died. And those that could not come, she talked with on the telephone. Now, it seems to me that if anyone ever had a right to be self-concerned, and if ever there was a time when she had every justification to be primarily focused upon herself, it was Joan, and it was then. But she lived out this lesson of humility that she cared more about others and their needs than she cared about herself and her own needs. That's the way it was with Jesus on that Sabbath day when he was invited to the home of a prominent Pharisee. They were watching him. He was under scrutiny because they were hoping that he would make a mistake, that he would somehow trip up, that they could add this to the log of all of the things that they had against him. In fact, they had set a trap, and the bait in the trap was a man who was sick, and they thought that if Jesus cured the man on the Sabbath, he could be accused of law-breaking on a day when you're not supposed to work. But on the other hand, if he didn't cure him, that he could be accused of lacking compassion. Now, the man suffered from dropsy. There's a medical term that we don't much use anymore. The modern term for that is edema. It is an accumulation of fluid in the body. And it could well be argued that it was hardly the cause for a 911 call. I mean, normally, you don't dial 911 and say, "My ankles are swollen. Please send an ambulance." So it is arguable that Jesus could have put this off until another day besides the Sabbath day. Or you could hear this and see this quite differently and say that Jesus had medical insights that the people at his time did not fully understand. That, in fact, edema is a symptom and not a cause, and it could be a symptom of congestive heart failure or some very serious other malady. And that Jesus, perhaps recognizing that maybe this was this man's last day to live or to be seriously incapacitated, chose to heal him on that holy day. Or you could spin it yet one more way, and that is that Jesus really didn't talk about the medical aspects. He was concerned about the person. He had compassion for the man. He asked the Pharisees what they would do if on a religious holiday one of their sons fell into a well. Not just a son, suppose it was an ox. Wouldn't they step up and do whatever needed to be done for rescue? And they didn't answer. They were silent. Because everybody knew what the answer was. Of course they would provide that type of care. And Jesus is saying, I have that same kind of compassion for this man. And so, He healed him. Healed him without concern of what other people would say or what other people would think. Jesus ignored the scrutiny that he was under and focused upon the man who had a significant need. He was primarily concerned about someone else. I think that this first lesson from Jesus is really a good self-test. For each of us, I suppose, could estimate what percentage of our time, thought, and energy goes into ourselves and goes into others. For I doubt that anyone is at 100% one way or the other. We all legitimately have self-concerns, and we all legitimately, at least for our own family members or those closest to us, have concerns about others. I would say if the percentage is 51% or more of concern for someone else, that is an assurance to you that you could be classified by Jesus' lesson as a humble person. Lesson number two is that the humble person lets others go ahead. In Jesus' case, he was talking about a wedding reception where the places of honor were up front, and he was saying, if you choose to sit at the head table and somebody better comes along and the host kicks you out and gives you the last seat that is left in the back, then you're embarrassed by that. It would be better to sit in the back and have the host come and invite you to come up to the head table. I've been on more than the usual number of airplanes lately, and it's just a fascinating, wonderful place to watch people and their behavior and eavesdrop on what they're saying. I was on one flight where a man was well-situated in his first-class seat. He had his beverage served. His luggage was in the overhead rack. And it turned out that there were two men named Schultz assigned to the same seat. And so the agent came on and kicked him out of his seat and put him somewhere in the back. I don't know really where, but I assume it was a middle seat, back row, didn't recline next to the bathroom. And he was probably angry or embarrassed or humiliated. By contrast, I was on another flight when a man was called by name to bring his gatherings and to come and take a first-class seat. Don't know why that was, but everybody on the plane just sort of watched him work his way up with awe and envy, impressed that this man who had sat in the back was now going to sit in the big seats up front in first class. But this past week, a most intriguing thing. The plane was oversold, and there were actually more people trying to get seats than there were seats. It was sort of like children with musical chairs, and everybody was trying to find a place to sit down. And they took off the non-revenue passengers, and they still had one more person than they had seats. So they called this man, Mr. Blumgarten, by name, told him to bring his possessions and get off the plane. And he made his way up, and I listened as he had a conversation with someone nearby. And they asked him, do you work for the airline? He said, no. And said, do you have a non-revenue ticket? He said, no, I paid full price for a coach ticket. And this person said, well, then why are you being asked to leave the plane? He said, I have no idea why I'm being asked to leave the plane. And he was gracious. And he was kind, and he did not grumble. And he simply asked the agent if it was going to be possible to get on the next flight to Minneapolis. I think he was a humble man. I think he was the kind of person that was willing to give up his seat for someone else. Jesus was teaching his listeners, teaching us, how to position ourselves in life. And he says, do it near the bottom, in the back of the plane, at the less important place. And then Jesus made a dazzling promise. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Jesus taught that those who push themselves ahead of others will end up on the bottom, and those who are willing to take the back place will end up at the top. Except most of us are thinking, not where I work, not where I go to school, not where I live. We're in a competitive society where if you don't watch out for yourself and push ahead, you're never going to get ahead. And you do all this stuff and people will walk all over you. So I guess we have to decide. We have to decide whether we think Jesus is right or not, and whether his way, in fact, actually does work. Lesson number three is that the humble person gives without expecting in return. And Jesus uses another food story to make his point. He suggests that his listeners have a dinner, but don't invite relatives and friends and rich people. Don't invite those who will do something in return for you, but instead invite those who are disabled, those who are poor, those who are disadvantaged. Jesus assumes that those who lack humility are always looking to get something in return, and that unhumble people, I know that's probably not a word, but should be, unhumble people are those who expect a reward, who expect to get something, who expect thanks, who expect a promotion or expect a favor. By contrast, the humble person gives out of pure generosity and honestly doesn't expect to get anything back. Now, we can test ourselves on this one as well. When sending a Christmas card this year, do you make a mental note to see if you are put on the list of the person to whom you sent the card to make sure that you get a Christmas card back next year? Or when inviting someone out to lunch and you pick up the check, do you make a mental or a written note that says that you expect that person to pay for lunch the next time you're out together? Or at work, when doing someone a favor, do you think of it in terms of accumulating chips that you can then turn in and get another favor in return? When giving to a charity, do you expect that there will be recognition and perhaps be offended if not adequately recognized? The way Jesus sees it, humble people just love to give, and proud people just love to get. The delight of giving without the expectation of anything in return is one of the marks that identifies a humble person. The fourth and last lesson in the list explains, I think, how all of the other lessons work. It is that the humble person trusts God for life's rewards. Because frankly, these lessons can be very hard to understand. Who can live life mostly concerned about other people, and who can live life always giving without expecting to get anything back? Who can live life always taking the lesser place? That is very risky behavior unless somehow this system actually works. But you see, whether we buy into Jesus' system or not depends upon our understanding of rewards and how rewards function. If this is all there is to life, if there is nothing more, and if God is not the final and great rewarder, then Jesus' system is crazy. If we measure our lives by titles and by money and by position and by human recognition, then following Jesus' way would be foolish. It's not a reasonable definition of humility. But if the real rewards come later, if they really come from God, then the person who does it Jesus' way is smart. I remember reading a story about a bicycle race in India. And the object of the race was, within the specified time from the starting gun to the finishing gun, to go the shortest distance possible. So everyone queued up at the line. Someone had a gun that they shot, and all the bicycles, as best they could, stayed put. You were disqualified if you tipped over or one of your feet touched the ground. And so they would inch forward or millimeter forward, the smallest possible amount, just enough to keep the balance on the bicycle. And then when the time was up, another gun was shot, and the person who had gone the farthest was the loser, and the person who was closest to the starting line was the winner. Now, imagine, as Americans, getting into that race and not getting the fine points of how this works. So you're at the starting line, and the gun is sounded, and you start pedaling as hard and fast as you possibly can. You're out of breath. You're sweating. You look back. You are delighted. Most of them are still back there at the starting line. You're going to break the record. This is fantastic. Don't let up just because they're not doing very well. Push harder and faster and longer and stronger until at last You hear the sound at the end of the race, and you are delighted because you are unquestionably the winner. Except you're unquestionably the loser. Because you misunderstood how the race is run. It is here that Jesus is giving to us the rules of the eternal race of life. He's telling us that the finish line is painted on the other side of our deaths, right in front of the throne of God Himself, and that you will there be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. That the winning strategy for this life and for all of eternity is humility and not pride. It is caring about others and not about ourselves. It is letting others go first and not pushing to the front. It is giving without the expectation of getting something in return. It is to be humble, like Jesus. But before we finish, it is important to understand that there is a strange thing about humility. Those who think they have it don't. Humility itself can never be the quest, can never be the goal. The goal is to live like Jesus. The goal is to be concerned for others. The goal is to put others first. The goal is to generously give. There is a tantalizing line in the Old Testament book of Isaiah. Chapter 66 and verse 2 tells who God esteems of our human race. He is quoted as saying, "This is the one I esteem, he who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word." May that be you. May that be me. May we be humble and exalted by God. Father, teach us the lessons from the life and the example of Jesus. May the quest of our lives not be the humility, but the Christ. And as we follow the example of Jesus, may we be like him and be all that you meant us to be. In his name.